Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Laura Landon. The song you're hearing is called Canada by the late orchestra leader and trumpeter Bobby Jimbie. He wrote the song for Canada's 100th birthday celebrations in 1967. It earned him the nickname the Pied Piper of Canada. The tune caught the optimistic, upbeat mood of the mid-1960s, when the Canadian economy was booming and governments were pouring money into social programs, such as national health care, improved old age pensions, and more generous social assistance benefits. They were also improving what Canadians call equalization. It's a program that redistributes wealth collected from taxpayers in richer provinces such as Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia to governments in poorer provinces such as Manitoba, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia. Equalization is meant to ensure that no matter where they live, all Canadians receive comparable levels of public services, including health care, education, and welfare, without having to pay higher taxes than in other parts of the country. Equalization is enshrined in the Canadian Constitution, but according to a new book, Canada's commitment to the idea behind it is fading. The book, Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea, is by the Canadian journalist Richard Starr. He writes that the federal government in Ottawa is now transferring more money to the richer provinces on a per capita basis than to the poorer ones. As a result, citizens in poorer provinces are paying higher taxes and receiving lower levels of government services. Moreover, neoconservatives in the national media and at big think tanks are telling Canadians that the poorer provinces don't deserve federal help. That even though the poorer provinces have smaller populations and therefore fewer taxpayers to support social programs, they should stop complaining and simply pull themselves up by the bootstraps. It's a chorus that makes no sense to Richard Starr. He says the wealthy provinces got rich because they happened to have abundant natural resources. Alberta, for example, is in the midst of another oil boom. Richard Starr has worked as a journalist, civil servant, broadcaster, political staffer, and policy advisor. His other books include a biography of the late New Brunswick Premier Richard Hatfield and Power Failure, A History of Energy Development in Nova Scotia. Richard Starr is married to former Member of Parliament Wendy Lill, who was also a well-known Canadian playwright. They live in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, where Richard Starr sat down for an interview with New Books Network contributor Bruce Wark.
Richard, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
You're welcome. I welcome the opportunity.
Your book is called Equal as Citizens, and what do you mean by equal as citizens?
Well, I guess the issue of equality is huge in any country, and there's a lot of emphasis, of course, on economic equality among classes, among races. And when we look at the issues surrounding, for example, the dreadful treatment of our Aboriginal people. But I'm taking a somewhat narrower view of the question of equal as citizens, and I'm looking specifically at government services, public services, the availability of public services. And I think the idea of equal as citizens has been fairly well summed up by Michael Ignatieff, the former Liberal leader, who participated in a debate in Calgary a couple of years back. And essentially he said that the level of public services available shouldn't depend on your postal code. And I think that sums up the idea of equal as citizens.
Let's explore that a bit in the Canadian context. Why is there a problem that would require you to write a book about it?
Well, I guess the problem is that we have a constitutional responsibilities that have been given to or acquired by the provinces over time, but they don't necessarily have the economic wherewithal, the fiscal capacity to provide those services. Most notably, education, going back many, many years, is a clear provincial responsibility. And history is replete with examples of how the poorer provinces had a much poorer level of education, with results that we're probably still living with in Canada. And more recently, of course, healthcare, which many Canadians see as a crucial part of the Canadian identity. Nevertheless, healthcare is at least 75% paid for by provincial governments, and those provincial governments have differing capacities in terms of their ability to provide those services.
Well, we're sitting here in Nova Scotia, one of the Atlantic provinces, and I would think that, judging from what you say in your book, that Nova Scotia is one of those poorer provinces that has had problems funding health and education.
Yes, and certainly in recent years, I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but in recent years, that problem has become more and more pronounced. Historically, for example, with our education system, as early as the 1910s, Nova Scotia politicians were complaining about the fact that teachers in Western Canada, for example, were getting paid three or four times what they could afford to pay their teachers in Nova Scotia, so they were losing their best teachers to other provinces. In subsequent years, there were significant gaps in the level of health services available to people in Nova Scotia and other Atlantic provinces, as well as the Prairie provinces. Fewer doctors, fewer nurses, fewer hospitals, those kinds of things. We've made efforts over the years to catch up, but currently we're moving, I would say, in the opposite direction. And the future ability of the less wealthy provinces to provide services, healthcare services in particular, to an aging population is in considerable jeopardy.
From Equal as Citizens by Richard Starr. Provincial funding for autism spectrum disorder varies widely across the country. A survey by the Library of Parliament in 2006 found the proverbial patchwork of service. Alberta offered more than $40,000 per child annually for treatment, generating media reports about families moving from other provinces, especially Saskatchewan, to take advantage. Ontario was spending about $10 per capita on services for autistic children. Prince Edward Island and New Brunswick were spending about $3 per capita. There are other examples where there is a direct correlation between provincial fiscal capacity and services. For instance, a report by the Canadian Institute for Health Information found that care for diabetics was almost non-existent in the Atlantic provinces in the middle of the first decade of the 2000s. Another report from March 2012 revealed that wait times for hip and knee replacements were increasing across Canada. The longest waits were in the Maritime provinces and Manitoba, the shortest in Ontario.
You're listening to an interview with Canadian journalist Richard Starr about his new book, Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea. The interviewer is Bruce Wark.
You write in your book that after Confederation, 1867, it took more than 80 years for the politicians to build a transfer system from the richer to the poorer provinces. Why did it take so long?
Well, I think part of it was that governments during that period didn't provide much in the way of public services. So there wasn't a large demand by citizens to provide those kinds of services. It was only in the 1920s that people in the poorer regions started to realize that people in other places were getting things like old age pensions and mother's allowances and those kinds of beginnings of the welfare state, and they weren't getting them. So provincial politicians started to feel some demand from citizens for those kinds of services. That's part of it. I don't think the political pressure was there for anybody to do much. Of course, the other part of it was the whole unequal arrangement of political power in the country. I mean, we had the four initial partners in Confederation were Ontario, Quebec, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia, and so the less wealthy provinces were outnumbered numerically. So any pressure that provincial premiers would put on for additional funding was easily disregarded, except in certain political circumstances where suddenly it was important to court political support and votes in some of those poorer regions.
Yeah, you're referring, I guess, to the what is now Ontario and Quebec with huge populations and then small populations in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick.
Yeah, and I mean, Ontario's attitude, and I don't want to get into Ontario bashing, but I think it's fairly clear that Confederation was a scheme that was dreamed up by Ontario politicians primarily for the benefit of Ontario. Quebec saw some benefit in it as well, believing that they could have some influence and support from New Brunswick and Nova Scotia initially, and eventually Prince Edward Island, to offset the kind of imperialistic dreams of Ontario. But it was very much an Ontario project, and there was significant political forces in Ontario, particularly in the Liberal Party of George Brown and Mr. Blake, that were not interested in sharing any of their wealth with the eastern provinces, with the poorer provinces.
Now, the system that was eventually set up, an equalization formula and transfer of money for social programs, came in the mid-50s. You've already mentioned some of the factors that led to that, but let's just talk about them in more detail. What happened in the years before the mid-50s in Canada that made a transfer system seem like a good and workable idea?
Well, mainly what happened and brought this into focus was the Depression and the impact of the Great Depression on the prairies, where the problem was the collapse in grain prices. And so what had previously been a fairly prosperous area, and an area that at the time, in the years prior to that, politicians of the Maritimes had looked at with some envy, suddenly became an economic basket case. So the federal government, which was always reluctant to provide much in the way of funding to the provinces up to that point, were forced to do something to help out Saskatchewan and Manitoba in particular, but Alberta as well. So that was number one. And out of what happened, out of the dire financial situation that existed on the prairies in particular, but also across the country, we had what became known as the Rolls-Irwaugh Commission. And it was, in the book, I praise it as just a great sort of spin-free source of information on what was going on in Canada at the time, and on the defects of the fiscal system that had developed in Canada at the time. Rolls-Irwaugh had hearings across the country between 1937 and 1940. They produced a report which essentially said that we need a system whereby the federal government can transfer tax revenues from taxpayers in prosperous provinces to provinces that do not have the fiscal capacity to provide a comparable level, or they called it a normal level, of public services to their citizens. Now, interestingly, from a maritime perspective, those kind of ideas had been emerging in Nova Scotia in the years prior to the Rolls-Irwaugh Commission. And in particular, Angus L. MacDonald, who was the long-serving premier of Nova Scotia, had made a similar case earlier in the 30s. So a lot of the ideas that Rolls-Irwaugh carried forward had originally come from Angus L. MacDonald and the Nova Scotia Liberal government at the time. Now, in 1940, when those ideas came forward, of course, Canada was already at war. The large provinces, the rich provinces, if you will, British Columbia, and surprisingly Alberta, and Ontario, and Quebec, for different reasons, were not keen on the idea. So the proposals didn't go anywhere during that time. However, accompanied with that, the feds had to move into a greater level of taxation to support the war. In order to do that, they had to get the provinces to back out, or there would have been double taxation. So the provinces essentially rented their tax room to the feds so the feds could prosecute the war effort. So those two things together, the role of Sirois ideas and sort of the basic necessity of increasing the role of the federal government and federal revenue, combined so that by Reconstruction after the war in 1945, there was a desire at the federal level to maintain some of that economic control. And out of that desire, they developed a permanent system of transfers that kind of took 10-12 years for it to take final shape. But the forces that led to it were specifically the Depression, followed by the war, followed by an ideological shift in the post-war period that, the sort of the Keynesian idea that the federal government had to have a greater control over the economy to regulate things, to prevent the kind of destruction that had caused by the Depression, plus the fact that, you know, coming out of the war, there was a move to the left politically in Canada. The CCF, which had been formed in the 1930s, was picking up traction. They were bringing forward a lot of the ideas that were current in the UK at the time around the welfare state. And so for, I would say, political reasons, the governing liberals decided that they needed not only to exercise control over the greater control over the economy, they also needed to look at some social programs that, because they were national, would be national in scope and would benefit all Canadians.
You're listening to an interview with Canadian journalist Richard Starr, author of Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea. The official launch for the book was held in Halifax, Nova Scotia on September 4th, 2014. Former Member of Parliament Wendy Lill welcomed those who attended the launch.
Thank you for coming tonight. We are hoping that we have a lively discussion tonight about the ideas that are presented in this book that we're launching, Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea. The book illuminates how our regional characteristics and interprovincial grievances have developed, and it challenges us to consider what it means to be a Canadian. It's gutsy, it's carefully researched piece of work. Believe me, it's carefully researched. I have been involved in this for years. I think it really rebalances the discourse in a very much needed way.
That was former Member of Parliament Wendy Lill, welcoming people to the official launch of the new book, Equal as Citizens. Wendy Lill is also married to Richard Starr, and they live in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. You're listening on the New Books Network to an interview with Richard Starr, conducted by Bruce Wark.
Richard Starr, you point out in your book, Equal as Citizens, that this idea of transferring wealth from the richer provinces to the poorer ones sort of came out of a movement toward a stronger federal government during the war, out of the experience of dire poverty in some regions during the Depression. And so we get in the mid-50s, 1957, a kind of formal program set up to transfer this wealth. What happened after that in Canada?
Okay, I just want to correct one thing. Yeah. The equalization is not a transfer from richer provinces to poorer provinces. What it is the federal government collects probably a little more taxes than it needs to in order to fund a program. A transfer program. Everybody contributes. Anybody who pays federal taxes contributes to the equalization program. We all pay for health care. It's just that when I pay my taxes for health care, you pay your taxes for health care. But there aren't enough millionaires in Nova Scotia so that when all is said and done, our capacity is less. So if we're going to have a certain level of health care, we need help from the federal government. I mean, that's sort of the, so it's not, there's no interprovincial transfers of any of this stuff. It's a question of certain provinces have greater fiscal capacity. Newfoundland is a good example. Until Newfoundland struck oil, Newfoundland's fiscal capacity was about 65% of the national average. It struck oil, all kinds of royalties flowed into the Newfoundland Treasury. Its fiscal capacity is now about 125% of the national average. But all that means is that Newfoundland doesn't get equalization payments anymore. There's no more money leaving Newfoundland in that sense, and Newfoundlanders aren't sending checks to Ontario.
Right, right. So that
although it might be fun if they did.
Yeah. The other idea in your book, the crucial one here, is that not only healthcare in Nova Scotia, but healthcare in Nova Scotia that will be comparable to healthcare in the richer province of Alberta or Ontario.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's sort of two parts to that that question, whether it's healthcare or any other public service, and the first part is, as a Canadian citizen, is it your right to expect the same level of healthcare in Nova Scotia that you get in Ontario? And if you believe that that is the case, but the province in which you happen to reside doesn't have the fiscal capacity to provide that, then yes, that's an argument for a federal transfer so that you can get that. So that's a federal transfer that helps me if I stay in Nova Scotia. But that federal transfer, and this was noted by, you know, the Royal Sirwa Commission back at the time, that transfer also benefits, say, a province like Alberta, which can afford better health care for its citizens. And that better health care can theoretically, and in fact, in some instances does, attract people from Nova Scotia or New Brunswick or wherever to go and take advantage of that better level of health care in Alberta. And that means that the people in Alberta are further back in the queue. I mean, so they are benefiting as well from a transfer system that enables citizens to stay where they are and move for economic reasons. I mean, that's the other part of it. You know, in our system, it's a given, I suppose, that you move from one part of the country to the other to get jobs. And we consider that to be a good thing most times, although if you've been in a traffic jam in Toronto lately, you'd wonder about that. But we do consider that a good thing. But we don't consider it a good thing to have people moving from one region to the other to take advantage of more lucrative or more generous public services in another place.
Richard Starr, in your book, Equal as Citizens, you talk about some very good years in Canada, years that just doesn't get better than that, I suppose, starting in the late 50s and into the 1960s. What happened in that period?
Well, actually, the momentum for those decades happened briefly in the post-war period. I mean, they had the Reconstruction Conference, and if you read those transcripts, you think, my goodness, the kind of things that the federal government was talking about at that Reconstruction Conference, we can only dream about today. They were talking about a national healthcare system, 60% funded by the federal government. Today, it's 25%. So those ideas that came up at that post-war conference kind of went underground for 10 years. The Mackenzie King in particular, and then his successor, Louis Saint-Laurent, looked around and said, hey, wait a minute, there's not massive unemployment that we expected to have. The barbarians are not at the gates. The doctors don't like Medicare anymore, although they did after the war. They were calling for it, but the doctors had changed their view. So all of this stuff just kind of disappeared for 10 years. But when the Liberals were defeated, oddly enough, that old red Tory, John Diefenbaker, kind of picked up that mantle and started taking some of those ideas. Now, of course, he was prodded along by Tommy Douglas in Saskatchewan, the CCF Premier of Saskatchewan, who had been elected in 1944, and was moving ahead on things at that time with health insurance. Diefenbaker followed that path and introduced hospital insurance back in the 1950s. And under Diefenbaker, the equalization program, which had not been called that after the war, but amounted pretty much to the same thing, was improved and formalized and had the consent at that time of both Quebec and Ontario. So it became an entrenched program. When Diefenbaker was defeated in 1963, equalization was again an issue in the campaign, and the Liberals were promising to improve it by essentially raising the standard to which all provinces would go. And the I think the Liberals essentially said, we're going to bring about more equalization by raising to the standard of the top two provinces rather than the average. So, in effect, there was that thrust in the 63 election. Of course, that was followed by the introduction of the Canada Pension Plan a couple of years later. And finally, well, not finally, by Medicare, in that started to be implemented in around our centennial year, 67, 68, up to about 1970. And I think the sort of the final spasm, if you will, was the unemployment insurance changes that were brought in under the Trudeau government in 1971, which was essentially a step back from the notion of a guaranteed annual income. They had been toying with the idea. There was support for the idea of a guaranteed annual income, but the feds figured it was too expensive. So they essentially redesigned the unemployment insurance program so that it kind of operated that way.
From Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea by Richard Starr. In 1971, the Trudeau government introduced major changes to unemployment insurance that moved the program firmly, if briefly, in the direction of income support and poverty reduction. In his book, From UI to EI, Waging War on the Welfare State, author Georges Campeau described the changes of 1971 as the centerpiece of Trudeau's Just Society. They were taken as a less expensive alternative to a guaranteed annual income and as a way around anticipated provincial objections. The reforms extended coverage to almost the entire workforce, established an 8-week eligibility period, raised regular benefits significantly, and introduced sickness, maternity, and retirement benefits. As a sign of the shift of emphasis from insurance to income support, the government increased its contribution to the UI fund, raising its share of the program cost from 19% to 44%. With inflation, an expanded labor force, and a 40% increase in the rate of unemployment also playing a role, unemployment insurance benefits burgeoned between 1970 and 1978. The five easternmost provinces experienced by far the largest increases. As with many initiatives of the late Pearson early Trudeau years, the Liberals balked at the first sign of trouble, scaling back the ambitious reforms amid media reports of program abuse and worries about the government's deficit. What would become a steady stream of reforms began in 1977, with reduction in benefits and tougher eligibility requirements.
You're listening to an interview with Canadian journalist Richard Starr about his new book, Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea. The interviewer is Bruce Wark.
We've talked about those years of the 1960s when the federal government, with the support of the provinces, brought in several social programs, including Medicare, Canadian health care. And then into the 70s, the early years of Pierre Trudeau's Liberal government, what happened to that sense of elation that Canadians felt around their centennial in 1967? What happened in the 70s that, I don't know if you would agree with this, but your book seems to suggest that undermined the ideal of having a country where the citizens are equal and receive comparable levels of service?
Well, there were a lot of bad things that happened in the 1970s. I mean, it started off with the October crisis in 1970, the kidnapping and murder of a Quebec politician by the FLQ in Quebec, a terrorist group devoted to the independence of Quebec. So, and the response, the federal government's response, put aside any notion that Pierre Trudeau was some kind of flower child. He basically declared the War Measures Act and locked up all kinds of people who had absolutely nothing to do with the FLQ. So that sort of any kind of rosy glow that was left over from the centennial celebrations kind of went with that. But in the long term, I think the more significant development, we started to see the emergence of the think tanks, the right-wing think tanks, the neoconservative think tanks. And that started primarily in the U.S., but and also in the U.K., and we got, you know, Margaret Thatcher as a result there. But it started to spread into Canada, and there was in the public sphere anyway. Increasingly, people were commentators, pundits, self-described intellectuals of various sorts. We're questioning this whole welfare state project. You know, we can't afford it anymore. Now, to sort of prove their point, the world economy went into a bit of a tailspin. I'm not qualified to get into the details of what happened to the post-war economy, except to say that it probably was kind of on steroids after the end of the Second World War, and the effect of the steroids wore off, and there was inevitably some decline in the American economy, and it dragged the Canadian economy down with it. Some of the other economies at the time, Japan, Italy, recovering from the war, did quite well, but American and Canadian dominance, which had existed in the 50s and in the 60s, which helped to finance and make possible the beginnings of the welfare state in Canada, that dominance started to fade during that period. So, you know, the neocons blamed it on too much government and came up with their own solution. So that sort of happened on the intellectual level, if you will. But combined with that was the run-up in oil prices, which had a positive and negative effect on Canada, in that Canada had, especially in Alberta and to a lesser extent in Saskatchewan and British Columbia, had significant oil and gas resources, so that those prices, the increase in those prices, added to Canada's national wealth. But unfortunately, because resources were a provincial responsibility, most of the benefit accrued to the oil-producing provinces. So that produced a shift of economic power from the center, from Ontario and to some extent Quebec, to the western provinces. It brought about some fairly intense interregional tensions. It's funny, this bumper sticker that said, "Let the Eastern Bastards Freeze in the Dark," if you sort of go through the media, you'll see that that's attributed to Peter Lougheed, Ralph Klein, any number of real people. But in fact, nobody seems to know who did that. But it started appearing on bumpers in Alberta in about 1975-76. And transfers were at the core of it. What happened was Ottawa froze the price of oil, domestic oil, and put a tax on exports, collected the tax on exports, and used that tax in order to subsidize offshore oil in Quebec and the Maritimes. The fact that Quebec and the Maritimes were dependent on imports of oil was the result of a direct federal policy that had been brought in the 1960s. So this was an unintended consequence of that particular policy, that one part of the country could have benefited from Canadian resources, but the other part of the country was dependent on imports. However, what the Western provinces really wanted was the world price for their oil, right? And so that caused huge resentment. The fact that they weren't getting the world price caused one element of the resentment. The fact that the reason they weren't getting that price and the difference between what they were getting and what they thought they should be getting was going to Quebec and Ontario. And we're talking billions of dollars here. It was not insignificant, the value of that transfer. Created huge tensions. Then on top of that, of course, in 1976, Quebec elected an avowedly separatist government in the PQ. So the 70s basically were a bit of a mess overall, and the whole idea of building a strong united Canada with equal citizenship seemed to fade away.
You're listening to an interview about the book Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea by Richard Starr.
The other thing that emerged during the 1970s and is still with us today is the federal government essentially backed off taxes. Under John Turner, as finance minister, and his successor, they did a number of tax breaks to individuals and to corporations. And as a result, one estimate is that in 1979, $20 billion, which at that time would have been close to 25% of the federal budget, the cost of those tax cuts was in the order of $20 billion. So when you have a federal government that's not collecting as much taxes as it previously had, its ability to transfer those money to the poorer provinces declines. And in fact, that's what happened. And in particular, health care, which had been introduced with great fanfare in the 60s into the early 70s, they almost immediately on its introduction, they were trying to find ways to save money and reduce the federal transfers. That 70s concern about tax rates has continued right down to the present day. So what we have in Canada is sort of a half-constructed welfare state that the federal government really was never prepared to pay for.
Richard Starr, author of the book Equal as Citizens, you mentioned the tax cuts of the 1970s. And of course, with those tax cuts came rising government deficits and debt. Another factor, I suppose, in the argument against generous social programs. How did that argument play out in terms of the equality of all citizens in Canada, whether they be in the richer provinces or the poorer ones?
Well, I mean, they had the impact that you would expect, in that any demands for greater equity, whether it be equity for provinces or individuals even, were met with the, you know, we can't afford it. We'd like to do it, but look at our deficit. It's the key issue. So it became a way of fending off any further attempts to increase equality of citizens.
When your book looks at the 1980s, it's kind of mixed there, because something really dramatic happens in the 80s with the new constitution, that Canada finally got full control of its constitution. What happened constitutionally that was significant?
The one that we think about all the time is the Charter of Rights. I mean, that is quite significant in our country. But as well as that, there are just two sections down. The first 34 sections of the Constitution are essentially the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Section 35, which is another story and probably a sadder story than Section 36, but Section 35 deals with Aboriginal rights. And then Section 36 is about equality, I'd say, is about equal citizens. It's a commitment by not just the federal government, but all governments in Canada to the provision of comparable public services at comparable rates of taxation. And that was in the Constitution of 1982. It was not controversial. So it is embedded in the Constitution, and that's very important. The difficulty is, from my perspective, is that nobody's paid much attention to it ever since. Citizens haven't paid a great deal of attention to it ever since. A lot of citizens and a lot of lawyers have paid attention to the first 35 sections of the new Constitution, but Section 36 tends to be overlooked, and its meaning tends to be overlooked.
From the Canadian Constitution Act of 1982, Section 36(1). Without altering the legislative authority of Parliament or of the provincial legislatures, or the rights of any of them with respect to the exercise of their legislative authority, Parliament and the legislatures, together with the Government of Canada and the provincial governments, are committed to A. promoting equal opportunities for the well-being of Canadians, B. furthering economic development to reduce disparity in opportunities, and C. providing essential public services of reasonable quality to all Canadians. Commitment respecting public services. Section 36(2). Parliament and the Government of Canada are committed to the principle of making equalization payments to ensure that provincial governments have sufficient revenues to provide reasonably comparable levels of public services at reasonably comparable levels of taxation.
We've talked about the early 80s, Richard Starr, and in your book, Equal as Citizens, you point out that equality of services was given protection in the Canadian Constitution. We've talked about that. But another thing happened in the 80s. In 1984, Brian Mulroney, the Conservative Party, won a landslide majority and started to make changes in the country. And how did that affect the overall prospect for equality as citizens?
Well, Mulroney, to be fair and balanced about Mulroney, his record is a bit mixed. I mean, the dialing back on equalization had already started. There was a New Deal in 1982, which reduced the amount of equalization going to the to the provincial governments, and also reduced the amount the federal government was going to put into that. But Mulroney was also responsible, on the other hand, to this sort of entrenchment, if you will, of provincial resource rights. The Peter Lougheed, the Premier of Alberta, following the introduction of the National Energy Program, had gone a bit ballistic on the whole thing, but then he proceeded immediately to negotiate with the federal government. And within a year or less than a year, they had come up with an agreement. And you also note that Peter Lougheed was the Premier of Alberta when the Constitution was approved in 1982. So implicitly, Alberta signed on to this whole notion of comparable services at comparable rates of taxation. But Lougheed also agreed to a deal on the division of revenues from resources that was twice as good as what we have today. Mulroney came along and, for strictly political reasons, his energy minister, Pat Carney, later acknowledged that their position on resources had basically been written by the oil industry, and so part of that was dismantling the National Energy Program. So in dismantling the National Energy Program, Mulroney essentially gave away about 50% of prospective revenues from oil and gas, the oil and gas industry. So that, I think, that was one of the key developments under Mulroney that has kind of carried through to today, where all you have to do is say national energy. I mean, as far as I know, Pierre Trudeau's son, the current leader of the Liberal Party, it doesn't support the National Energy Program, right? So that very successful slaying of that particular dragon, and Mulroney was a big part of it. Mulroney also put a lid on transfers for health and education, called the Established Programs Financing. So provinces started to have greater difficulty financing their health care programs. But the other part of it was, again, more, as I say, a mixed record. As part of that mixed record, Mulroney, of course, for his own bizarre reasons, wanted to get Quebec to sign on to the Constitution. As we know, that failed. Leech Lake failed. But then Mulroney sponsored the Charlottetown Accord, which also failed. But the Charlottetown Accord was an improvement on some of the social programs that would have been an improvement. What they talked about was devolving greater powers to the provinces, but also beefing up the federal government's redistributive role and strengthening the equalization clauses in the Constitution. Unfortunately, that failed. Nobody talks about the Charlottetown Accord anymore. But what succeeded, of course, as part of what is perceived as the neoconservative rise in Canada, what succeeded was the free trade deal. And I would say the major impact of the free trade deal on the issue at hand was that it provided one more sort of rationale for not sharing. One of the rationales for sharing of the wealth was that it recirculated back. The money would come from Ottawa, collected disproportionately from Ontario, But people in Nova Scotia would then spend that money buying goods from Ontario. In the 30s and the 20s and back into the beginnings of the national policy in the 19th century, that had some currency. By the time the actual free trade deal came along, the tariffs were so low that probably didn't even exist. And recent figures indicate that Ontario, that the Maritimes continue to buy huge quantities of goods from Ontario. So it's probably a canard, but it provided one more rationale for dismantling that whole system, because we don't need it anymore, or the equity isn't there because people are buying their goods from all over the place.
From Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea by Richard Starr. Between 1997 and 2012, per capita federal cash transfers to the provinces increased by 143%, according to Finance Canada figures. Ontario led the way with an increase of 255%, followed in order by British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Quebec. Manitoba, the Maritime provinces, and Newfoundland combined received per capita increases of only 45%. The election of the Harper government in 2006 put a stop to any immediate prospect of improved equity through national programs such as early childhood education. The Harper Conservatives made it clear in their first budget that it was their goal to shrink the size of the federal government and stay out of provincial jurisdiction. For the poorer provinces, the question became the extent to which the Conservatives would also shrink the transfers they would need to carry out those increased responsibilities. Looking at the Harper government's record over 8 years, it is clear that their policies continued the trend favoring the richer provinces. This is no great surprise given the Conservatives' political base and their economic bent. What is discouraging is the lack of controversy surrounding this development. Perhaps Canadian society has become less generous toward others, even when those others just live in a different province. Perhaps we've become indifferent to and bored by the claims of provincial politicians for more money from Ottawa. Or perhaps we have simply been misinformed. Whatever the reason, Canada is moving farther away from achieving common citizenship, the goal of equal treatment in public services and taxation that once motivated our political leaders.
You talk about a kind of Robin Hood in reverse effect, with more money now under per capita funding, equal per capita funding, going to the richer provinces.
All funding. If you add them all up, and it's no secret. I mean, it's on the Government of Canada's website. If you add up the equalization, the Canada Health Transfer, Canada Social Transfer, you can see quite clearly that in recent years, it's going disproportionately to the better-off provinces. But if you trace it back even to the 10 or 15 years, you see that has been the trend.
And in the background to that, then, is a kind of ideological war, a claim from pundits and politicians themselves that maybe it should be that way, that the poorer parts of Canada should be pulling themselves up by the bootstraps and not depending on handouts from the federal government and the richer provinces. You have a lot to say in your book about this. What happened there and is happening, I suppose?
Well, I alluded to the think tanks a while ago, and I think they've played a fairly pervasive role in that in getting that notion out there. And to a considerable extent, our elites, if I can use that word, our political and business elites have bought into that notion. Somehow we can turn back the forces of geography and everything, and suddenly pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and become a half province. Well, in our history, that the only way to move from one to the other. I mean, Ontario is moving perhaps in the other direction, but in our history, the only way to move from one to the other is to strike oil. And you know how that can be somehow equated with pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. I'm not sure, but that. that fact is overlooked.
So on the one hand, we've got an anomaly here. We've got Section 36 of the Constitution, which guarantees, or at least refers to, talks about comparable levels of services at comparable levels of taxation across the country, no matter where you are, in a rich province or in a poor one. We've got that. But on the other hand, it seems that in the mass media, we've got a prevailing frame that talks about not giving handouts to the undeserving. One of your chapters is called Changing the Frame. What is that frame, and how could we go about changing it when it seems that the dialogue in the mass media and from the think tanks is so overwhelmingly biased against transfers of wealth from the richer to the poorer?
Well, I think one way is to read my book. That's why I wrote it, because I think that it's important that people have a bit of the background, some understanding of that, know that Section 36, subsections 1 and 2 even exist, and then maybe start asking all politicians, essentially, because, I mean, as I say, all of the provinces signed on to that, as well as the federal government. Quebec didn't. But it wasn't because of that Quebec didn't. So, you know, I'm using a bit of poetic license here and saying that everybody supposedly agrees with it. Well, I guess I would say, okay, how are we doing on that, right? In Ontario, people have this kind of drug coverage, but I have to pay for that drug here. Or my nephew just moved to Alberta to take a job in the oil fields, and, you know, talks in the Constitution about equal opportunity. Where's the equal opportunity? And look at my tax bill. I'm paying, you know, 15% provincial tax, whatever it is. So what are you doing about living up to those aspirations, if you will, in the Constitution?
You're listening on the New Books Network to an interview with Richard Starr, author of Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea. The interview is conducted by journalist Bruce Wark.
Richard Starr, in your book Equal as Citizens, you have a last final chapter called Parting Shots, in which you outline a number of things that could be done to make us more equal, rich and poor together. And one of them, you mention a carbon tax. How would that work?
Well, it would be the, I guess the principle would be polluter pay. And when it comes to fossil fuels, Saskatchewan, God love them, and Alberta are by far the greatest producers of greenhouse gases, which by all available evidence is a problem. So the way it would work would be that you would put a tax on that, and then you would use that to distribute to other provinces. Now, there's different ways you can do it. The possibility could have been implemented many, many years ago to do it specifically within the energy sector. We could have had a cap and trade system in Canada, so that when Nova Scotia, for example, decreased its greenhouse gas emissions by four megatons, which, you know, 8% or so, 10% or so, there could have been some benefit accruing to the ratepayers of Nova Scotia Power in Nova Scotia, funded by a tax collected on the polluters in out west, right? We could have done that. We never set that up. Or you could simply have the carbon tax distributed just generally across the country, regardless of what their energy infrastructure happened to be. And the other part of it, though, is that, again, we have to change the terms of the debate. When we continue to associate positive things with fossil fuel development, when in fact the evidence is that those fossil fuel development of fossil fuel are negative, essentially, for our long-term survival as human beings. We have to change the terms of the debate so that when people demonstrate in New Brunswick against fracking, they are not considered criminals. That, in fact, they are welcomed and seen as people who are trying to move us towards a different kind of future.
You've been listening to an interview with Richard Starr, author of Equal as Citizens, The Tumultuous and Troubled History of a Great Canadian Idea. The interviewer was Bruce Wark. I'm Laura Landon. See you next time on the New Books Network.